Everyone, I'm just going to start out this morning by asking you if you remembered the moment when you were saved. Perhaps for you it was in a single moment. That moment, and maybe you couldn't ignore the overwhelming love that Jesus had for you, and you just had to make that decision. Or maybe for a lot of us here, probably it happened over time, and you can't really remember a single moment, but now you just know, you believe, you have faith. Salvation is the most significant decision you could ever make here on earth. When a sinner, so helpless and disconnected from God, is given hope in Christ, that is an incredible thing. This gracious gift that cannot be earned. Salvation is essential. But what's next? Is that it for us? Or is there more to life than being saved? I believe that there is, and that the Bible tells us that there is. And it encourages us to keep making good decisions. God raised us out of spiritual deadness so that we can live. Peter wrote a letter to believers living in a terribly difficult situation. And he was encouraging them that their salvation, not their circumstance, should dictate the life that they chose to live. In Peter's letter, we discover that there is more to life than being saved, that there are still choices to be made and actions to be taken. We are called to live the good life. And what I mean by the good life is not the traditional sense of let's all get a house and a car and a beautiful spouse and family and a picket fence, blah, 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 blah. It's not about good things happening to you. The good life in the First Peter sense is a Christian life where the responsibility to uphold God's moral standard is taken seriously. It is a life where we choose to do good works. And I want you to listen really carefully to this part because I don't want to be misunderstood. Good deeds are useless without Jesus. They don't get us closer to heaven or closer to God or anywhere. In fact, without Christ, good deeds are not good at all. Humanity's sin meant that we could never meet God's perfect moral and ethical standard. Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We all fall short of his standard. It was impossible until there was one that came and met this standard in his life. And then he offered that life to God on our behalf. If we should choose to accept this offering, this gift, then we can rest assured that we have a place in heaven with Jesus forever. But our good deeds can absolutely never merit salvation. Faith in Jesus' lifetime of good deeds, that is what gets us salvation. But that's not what I'm here to talk to you about this morning. I'm here to talk to you guys who are already saved. That is to say that there is still a choice to be made every day, every moment, to uphold the Christian responsibility or not. To live the good life, the life of good works, or not. Imagine your salvation is a block of land, and we should be able to do this easily because a lot of us have land. You are gifted a beautiful block. So it's different to the block of land you might own now. You're gifted it. It's given to you. You didn't earn it, but it is indeed yours. So it's up to you now what you do with it. You can leave it as it sits. Or you can build on it and you can plant on it. Find out what it's really worth, what it can really do. What you choose to do with it is your works here on this earth. If you build and sow good things on your land, then this is the good life. So let's explore the good life more in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 to 12, which Dougal read out for us earlier. So the first thing about the good life is that it involves community. The good life involves community. The good life is not a solitary one. We are meant to be part of a community made up of brothers and sisters who have been saved by God. And as a part of a community of Christians, we are to be characterized by our actions. Peter begins verse 8 with the word finally. And that indicates that he's finishing up a thought, finishing up something. And in this case, Peter is finishing up a section that he started at chapter 2, verse 11. And it finishes at the end of the passage that Dougal read this morning at 3, verse 12. He's covered up to this point the responsibilities of Christians in various situations, with an emphasis on submission, responsibility to honour government, responsibility of servants to submit to their masters, wives to their husbands, and husbands' responsibility to their wife. And so as he includes this section, which included all this stuff, we discover that as Christians, the good life we are to choose must involve community. The community which we call the church. And the specific examples of the actions we are to be characterized then follow. So let's read it. Verse 8. Finally, all of you be of one mind, having sympathy for one another, love as brothers, be tender-hearted, and be humble. So it starts out, we are commanded to be unified in mind. Be of one mind. This is not just human agreement together about anything and everything, but it is agreement which is reached by all receiving the truth of God. Agreement which is based upon a common heritage of faith and ethical tradition, which is Christ and what he taught. As a community, we're also commanded to be sympathetic, which is simply being able to see things from another person's point of view. This is not always easy because our culture teaches us to assert our own point of view at all costs. If you are married, then your marriage is a great place to start working on sympathy, because much of the time we want our spouses to understand our point of view. So we explain ourselves, and while we're explaining ourselves, the other is thinking about how they are going to explain themselves in reaction to how we've just explained ourselves. Did you follow that? The same is true of most arguments that anyone ever has. People hardly ever listen to the other side, other than to prove their own minds, in their own minds, how inadequate the other person is and their point of view. But we're commanded to be different from that, to be sympathetic, to be able to understand others' points of view. Then Peter says we are to be loving as brothers, and this is very simple. We are a family, and therefore we should love each other like family. A healthy family, of course, with our thoughts and with our actions. Then we're commanded to be kind, to be tender-hearted. That means we're commanded to be quick to feel, quick to show affection to each other. And we can easily miss this one because today we are bombarded with so much negativity and suffering through our media that it's so big and difficult for us to process, and we don't really know what we're going to do with all of this suffering, that we've just become callous to it because we're getting so used to it. But God calls us to be tender-hearted, which means that we're not only able to see things from another person's point of view, but also to feel for them and to mean it. And then we are called to be humble. And humility is a readiness to forego one's own rights. It is a Christ-like attitude towards oneself. And as is the case with all of these virtues, Christ is the supreme example, and it's no different with humility. If we look back in our Bibles to chapter 2 of the book of Philippians, we hear about Christ and his example. Chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. It says, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others as better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others." And then Christ's example comes down in verse 8. "And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross." That's Christ's example to us of humility. The Christian community, of which we are to be a part, should be a place of support and refuge. the hostility of the world, which is a major part of the context of 1 Peter, should not permeate its way throughout the church. Then following this, we are commanded to go against the grain of society, to be kind to the unkind, kind to the disagreeable, to the nasty, to the cruel, to vicious people we come into contact with. Verse 9 says, not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling, so that's insult for insult, but on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. But why should we? Why shouldn't we return insult for insult? How dare the world, how dare media, comedians, government, whoever, they ridicule us, they talk down to us, they proclaim how bigoted and simple-minded we are to believe such things. Why should we stand by while this injustice happens? Well, this is when a humble mind comes into play, where we forgo our right or our desire to respond in turn, to insult with insult. As Peter states in verse 9, we are to respond instead with blessing. This doesn't mean that we cover up a dissenting attitude with some calm and positive words, because that would be false humility, outward, with no real change. We are commanded in verse 8 to have humble minds. Our minds are to be changed. But the actual reason that we should not repay insult for insult is because we are followers of Christ. And it's a great saying, being a follower of Christ, because that is indeed what we are called to do, to follow him. So we follow his example. So what is his example in this case? Well, Peter sums it up in chapter 2, verses 21 to 25. So let's read Jesus' example. So it's just spoken to servants about their masters, even if they treat them badly, to still submit to them. Verse 21, for to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, did not revile in return. So who when he was insulted, did not insult in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed, for you were like sheep going astray, but now have now returned to the shepherd, the overseer of your souls. Our example is Christ, and we are called to imitate him. So the good life is one of community. It's not one of going it alone. The second thing a good life is it's a choice. It's not about making life here on earth good, as I said before, comfortable and nice. It's about choosing obedience over disobedience, good over evil. Verses 10 and 11. For he who would love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. So more specifically than just our actions in general, Peter mentions how we speak and how we react to the people we share this world with. So one specific example of the good life is provided in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 3, which is the good actions of a wife which can win over her husband when he observes her good works. Then it talks to us about the good actions of a believer. Peter talks about how they are important. And if you look to chapter 2, verse 12, which is likely a key verse for this section, and for much of the entire letter. And it says, having your conduct, your actions, your works, honourable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. Our conduct and our attitude is incredibly important to God, because with it we can glorify Him and cause others to do so as well. The consequence of a good life or a bad life are then presented to us in verse 12 of chapter 3. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and His ears are open to their prayers, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. A life characterized by honoring God's moral standard, the good life, means God is for you. The first half of verse 12 tells us that God watches out for the righteous, for the good, and He listens to their prayers. A life characterized by contempt for God's moral standard, an evil life, the second half of verse 12 tells us something that perhaps we're not very comfortable with, and that is that God opposes evildoers. And the context of this section of Scripture indicates to us that Peter is talking to Christians here. You can be a Christian and do the wrong thing. You can do evil things, and you can make that the pattern of your life. Ignorance to the commands in the Bible and pushing against the call to become Christ-like and follow His example. For those that make this the pattern of their life, the opposite of the first half of verse 12 should be expected. God will not be watching out for you, and your prayer life may be hindered. And the example for your prayer life being hindered comes back in verse 7, where husbands are commanded to do good by honoring their wives. Why? So that their prayer life will not be hindered. Patterns of sin in our life disconnect us from God. And if we take this in the wider context of the letter, we discover that our works as Christians, good or evil, will be judged by God. You go back to chapter 1, verse 17. It says, "And if you call on the Father, who without partiality judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves throughout the time of your stay here in fear." God's going to judge us. This implies that there will be loss and reward. And there's many other verses which talk about rewards for good works and losses, rewards for disobedience. And this makes some feel really uncomfortable. But do you think if you choose to live a disobedient, lapsy-daisy Christian life that you will get the same reward as someone who dedicates their entire life to God's work here on earth? God is just, meaning He is fair. God will reward and give consequences to His children. We are responsible for our actions. We teach our children this. If we are wise enough to teach, discipline, and reward our children, do we really think that God won't reward and discipline us? Are we implying that we have a better grasp on raising our children than He does? Does this principle cross over into our Christian lives? And do we consider the eternal rewards and consequences of our current actions? It shouldn't surprise us that obedience invokes God's favour. God called Adam and Eve to be obedient, the two who represent the entirety of humanity. He called Israel to obedience so that they could represent Him to the world. And He calls us now to good works, to obedience, so that we, the world, can see us and glorify God as well. We are to actively reject evil, to choose to do good in our lives. This is what the good life truly is. You can't do good works for your salvation, but you can do good works because of your salvation. Even though life can and does bring us terribly difficult situations, I want to encourage you that your salvation, not your circumstance, should dictate the life that you choose to live. Are you going to build on your inherited land, on your salvation? That could mean caring for your family, caring for the poor by feeding and clothing them. It could be serving on the Christian school board. It could be serving your spouse, building into your community by making meaningful friendships, ministering through serving, music, acting, dancing, counseling, whatever it is, the list goes on and on. Just choose the good life. Build big for God. Sow faithfully. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer. All right, we're going to close with a song. So let's do that and sing together.